So welcome everyone to one of our two July Intel Hub sessions. Today we have Dr. David Strachan-Morris presenting on the insurgent use of intelligence. David is a lecturer in intelligence and security at the University of Leicester, where he runs the Masters of Intelligence and Security program and also serves as the director of distance learning for the School of History, Politics, and International Relations. Prior to his academic career, he served in the Intelligence Corps in the British Army and worked in intelligence management roles in the private security industry, primarily in Iraq. Currently, his research focuses on intelligence education, non-state actor intelligence, and strategic intelligence. And today, for David's discussion, he looks forward to taking your questions as they arise, so feel free to type them in the chat, and I will work and do my best to MC the discussion. So without further ado, David, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Nicole. Welcome to the session, everybody. I'm glad to see such a big crowd here. As Nicole says, I'm going to be talking about non-state actor intelligence and how insurgents use intelligence. And it's probably worth giving a bit of background to this because it's part of a wider project that's going on in intelligence studies to look at non-state actor intelligence. And this particular project really arose out of a conversation a few years ago between myself and a colleague, in which we were talking about, obviously counterinsurgency was the big thing then, and how to do intelligence against insurgents. And we realized there was a gap in that nobody was really talking about insurgents as intelligence actors in their own right. So we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could get a group of people together to look at specific groups and just talk about how they do intelligence, which we've done. We've got five articles together. And they are going into a forthcoming edition of Intelligence and National Security, hopefully early next year. I look at, and what I'm going to be talking about today, the North Vietnamese use of intelligence, particularly in the Second Indochina War between 1965, and I say 1975, but actually sort of around about 1970, I kind of tail off. There's a reason for that. It's tied up with what was my PhD. We have Rachel Monahan from Ulster University, who is looking at Northern Ireland paramilitaries and how they've used open source intelligence for targeting, particularly with regard to the Supergrass trials, and how they then used the information reported in the media about those trials and the evidence in those trials to then target people. We have Paul Jackson, who's talking about the Nepalese communists during their successful insurgency there. Evripidis Tantalakis, who is a PhD student of mine, who will be talking about the Greek use of, or Greek communist insurgent use of intelligence in the Greek Civil War in the late 1940s. And then Raphael Bitton is talking about Hezbollah and Hamas. So I've kind of put them there out of order a bit, so my apologies for that. When they appear in INS, they'll be in chronological order. And really, this kind of feeds into some work that's now going on generally in intelligence studies about non-state actor intelligence. And we're seeing a lot, particularly on the commercial side, thanks to the likes of Efren Torres-Bashes, who's put together some panels on ISA, to really look at how that differs from national security and state-level intelligence, which I think is what most of us have tended to concentrate on. So I'm going to start really by talking through some of the theory about intelligence actors, just to give some background to where we're coming from when we talk about actors and then non-state actors, and then talk specifically about how violent non-state actor and insurgents use intelligence. So really, when we're talking about intelligence actors, what are we talking about? What is an intelligence actor? When can you talk about an activity being intelligence? So the literature I draw on from my article, really this has come from Ada Bozeman and Michael Warner, really. So intelligence actors, when I'm talking about an intelligence actor, I'm talking about an organization that's using intelligence or deploying intelligence assets rather than the intelligence organization itself. So we're talking about a sub-state, non-state actor that has an intelligence capability. And back in 1988, Ada Bozeman, she said that the state is not the decisive working unit for intelligence studies anymore, and that internationally relevant decision making emanates increasingly from scattered, often dissimulated command posts of liberation fronts, terrorist brigades, provisional governments, or international communist parties. And we can certainly see that in the range of organisations that we look at in the special edition, but also in some of the work that I'm going to be drawing on later in the article on by John Gentry, who looked at Al Qaeda, the Kosovo Liberation Army, and the FARC in Colombia. And I'm sure we can think of a number of others at the IRA in Northern Ireland. But when we're talking about what differentiates intelligence activity from any other kind of just information collecting activity, there is a debate here. And the debate really is sort of what separates intelligence actors and intelligence activity from just ordinary information collecting, say, for example, rival teams trying to figure out what the rival team's plays are. And for Michael Warner, he really talks about the competitive willingness to do violence to achieve aims or maintain security. And for him, when you talk about being able to qualify as an intelligence actor, it's when you're using intelligence because that intelligence is going to be used to do violence or potentially do violence and apply lethal force to achieve whatever your aims are. So I kind of agree with that to an extent. And so you get my last point there, sort of going off on a bit of a tangent. So where does that leave commercial actors? You know, can you really call what they do intelligence? And this, as I said, is kind of tangential to the real debate of the article. But I know some of you will be asking that question. So although it's beyond the scope of this article, I would argue that security intelligence used for defensive purposes, i.e. avoiding or preventing violence or lethal harm, sometimes through the use of lethal force, as commercial entities do, brings corporations back into play as intelligence sovereignties and intelligence actors in their own right. So that's the sort of broader theoretical background. So when we're talking about how we look at violent non-state actors, I'm sorry these are kind of floating in. When I sent this to Nicole, I thought I'd taken all the animations off. So one of the things that really springs to mind when you're looking at violent non-state actors and how they use intelligence is if you think about Jennifer Sims' theory of adaptive realism, where she talks about weaker states, but here we can apply it particularly to violent non-state actors and insurgency, and insurgents, which often are the weaker participant in a conflict. That the use of intelligence offsets the hard power. So the more they know about the people they're fighting against, the better they are able to use what limited resources they have and identify the weaknesses that they need to attack. And particularly if you read when the special edition comes out, if you read Evripides Tantalakis' article on the Greek communist insurgency, this really comes to the fore. And in fact, they were so successful in their intelligence efforts that actually defeating the communist insurgent intelligence organizations became a key aim of the counterinsurgents because that was the one key weakness that the counterinsurgents had identified. So we can say intelligence offsets the lack of power, the lack of military capability, and provides the means to identify weaknesses to attack. And also maintains security or achieve their ends through decision advantage. If you've got better intelligence and know more about what's going on, more about the environment than your enemy, then you can make better decisions and ideally faster decisions. And that's something that kind of does come through whenever you're looking at insurgents, that intelligence does become very key to their effort, obviously, as it is for more efforts. So what I did then when I was looking at the North Vietnamese was John Gentry wrote an article a couple of years ago in Intelligence and National Security toward a theory of non-state actor intelligence. And what he did was he proposed a framework, which I'm going to go through in on the next couple of slides, to show how non-state actor intelligence, he looks at three violent non-state actors, as I said, the Kosovo Liberation Army, the Colombian FARC, and Al-Qaeda. And then he also looked at NGOs, how NGOs and advocacy groups use intelligence. But for the purposes here, he came up with a model, a sort of theoretical analytical model to explain how insurgents use intelligence. And I thought it interesting to apply that then to the North Vietnamese to see, to test the model, see if it works under other circumstances. Now, I know that to a certain extent, North Vietnam, it's kind of a hybrid case, really. And it's one of the difficulties when you're looking at the North Vietnamese conduct of the war is trying to actually work out, were they insurgents, were they terrorists, was it a regular war? It was all of those. But what I found is kind of north of the border, North Vietnam behaves like a state, but everything south of the border is very much insurgent guerrilla type activity or behavior. So that's why I've used them as a case study. So just to talk through John's model there, basically what he did was he identified five intelligence activities or five key things that intelligence does. The quicker among you will notice that dissemination is missing from that. And that's because that's not unique to intelligence activity. What he was looking at was unique intelligence activities. So you have collection, actually going out and finding the information, analyzing the information, and then internal security, counterintelligence, and covert action. So what John found was that when it comes to collection, state actors gather information from a variety of sources in a variety of ways. So they've got IMINT, they've got SIGINT, they've got HUMINT, MAZINT, all of that good stuff. And the range runs from strategic, operational to tactical. That they collect on and that they collect for. Whereas for a violent non-state actor, they do aim for all source activity, but heavily reliant on, he says, HUMINT. What I found with the North Vietnamese, and Rachel Monahan's article talks about OSINT as well as HUMINT. Right, so sorry, Frederick, any research on the Soviet aid to NVA in SIGINT? No, not specifically. I did find that there was some aid from the Soviets and Chinese to the North Vietnamese, but it was fairly limited. I hope that answers your question there. So analysis. State actors tend to convert raw information to analytical judgments that are meaningful to government level, state level decision makers. And communicating intelligence analysis to consumers. And again, this is at strategic, operational, or tactical issues and for tactical audiences. Whereas for a violent non-state actor or insurgents, the analysis is mainly in support of ongoing military operations or counterintelligence and tends to stay at the tactical or operational level. And again, you can see how that plays out later in the discussion when it comes to the North Vietnamese. Internal security. John found that at the time he was researching and writing that this is a secondary activity. It's intelligence support to the police and other agencies that are dedicated to protecting the government and citizens. Whereas for a violent non-state actor, internal security, and particularly for the North Vietnamese, and this will come out in the lecture, internal security is vital to the existence of the organisation. It's one of the core roles of intelligence. And the same with counterintelligence. For intelligence organisations, mainly it's an adjunct activity to protect their own assets, protect their own activities, and support for and other government policies and activities. Whereas with insurgents or organizations, again, it's vital It is vital to the existence of the organization. This was, when you look at the North Vietnamese, if you look at sort of individual cells and lower level organizations, obviously it was vital to the existence of the cell. Not so much when you get further up, it becomes more state-like, as I said, when you sort of get north of the border. But if you look at organizations like the IRA, for example, internal security and counterintelligence was absolutely vital. In fact, it was one of the things that kind of wrapped them up. They got so bound up by the fact they'd been penetrated that it paralyzed them to a large extent. And then, of course, covert action. So, again, sort of an adjunct activity, foreign activities of political significance the governments wish to conduct under conditions of plausible deniability. So it's just one means of conducting of carrying out policy. Whereas again, for violent non-state actor insurgent terrorist organizations, that's actually a core function of the group if you look at what they do. It's terrorism, sabotage, and subversion. And these, particularly the last one, again, were key to how the North Vietnamese carried out intelligence. So that's the activities. When we come to looking at the use of intelligence, so again, John breaks this down into four types: basic intelligence, current intelligence, estimative intelligence, and warning intelligence. So for a state actor, basic intelligence, yes, they use it, but it diminishes as current intelligence becomes more important. For violent non-state actors, not much, he says, but includes data for targeting packages. Actually, I would say for what I found for the insurgency, particularly for the Vietnamese, a lot of basic intelligence. In fact, that was probably one of the main focuses. Current intelligence, yes, major effort, but on many topics. So not just a military focus, but we're talking about economic and political as well. Whereas for violent non-state actors, it was a military focus, and that was very much true for the Vietnamese. Estimative intelligence, John says, yes, but a modest effort, mainly obviously sort of forecasting. But for violent non-state actors, no. And there are, I think that is true across most violent non-state actors that I've looked at, but for different reasons. And then warning intelligence, yes, modest effort, but hard for states to figure out how to do. And we all know that. It's one of the things we wrestle with in intelligence studies. But for violent non-state actors, yes, it is a key focus. But they're looking for opportunities for attack. Which is very much true of terrorist and insurgent organizations. They're always looking for an opportunity to carry out an attack, particularly when they identify a weakness. And of course, immediate danger threats. So, what are things that are vital to the organization? So that's kind of the framework that I used in analysing the North Vietnamese for two reasons. First of all, to try and understand, well, did they behave like insurgents? But then also as another data point to try and to try and validate John Gentry's model. Marianne, I can just see your question there. Expect them to be heavily reliant on humans simply due to lack of resources and/or collection facilities. Yes, absolutely. When you haven't got that much in the way of technology, when you haven't got that much in the way of resources, then human is obviously cheap, and we can argue this point, but reasonably easy to do. So I think it's important to try and understand Vietnamese military doctrine to understand their approach to intelligence. I'm sure some of you, particularly in the United States, have studied this to death. It was all kind of new when I was saying it over here in the UK. So really, for the North Vietnamese, when they were conducting their war, they saw it as a combination of an armed struggle and a political struggle. The two were closely bound together, in fact, almost inseparable. And I said there, it's a combination of military action, propaganda, proselytization, and population control. So the military so had the struggle, or Dao Tran, excuse my pronunciation, those who can actually speak Vietnamese, So not only was it the means by which information on enemy capabilities and intentions was collected, but also had a two-way flow. So when we talk about intelligence for the North Vietnamese, you had proselytization going one way to the people and information about the people and the enemy to the leaders the other way. And of course, a successful political Đào Tràng campaign was an important precondition for the military struggle, since the political mobilization of the people was essential for precipitating the first stage of the military campaign, guerrilla warfare, which relied on the general population for recruits as well as safe havens and sources of logistic support. The political struggle needed to be maintained throughout the entire campaign, including the general counter-offensive, the final stage, in case a serious setback required that the military struggle revert to a low-level guerrilla warfare, or even cease altogether until the time was right for another attempt. And you do see the Vietnamese sort of going up and down the scale. You see it happening in sort of in the first Indochina War, but you do see it particularly in the second Indochina War as well. They have at least two goes at the general uprising, general counter-offensive, before 1975. So they have a three-stage military campaign, guerrilla warfare, which is, kind of sort of the, they call it, this is the form of the fighting of the masses of the people of a weak and badly equipped country who stand up against an aggressive army which possesses better equipment and technique. So this is all lifted from North Vietnamese writing here. Avoiding the enemy when he is stronger and attacking him when he is weaker. Determined to fight him everywhere so that wherever the enemy goes, he will be submerged in a sea of armed people who hit back at him, thus undermining his spirit and exhausting his forces. If that's successful, they move on to the second phase, mobile warfare, also referred to as the equilibrium phase, in which the forces begin to balance. But insurgents still don't have the strength to tip the strategic balance in their favor. So this is when the insurgents are bleeding the enemy's strength while at the same time continuing the guerrilla war and their efforts to secure the support of the general population. And then, of course, you have the general uprising, general offensive, which is the final stage, which is a combined military assault and popular revolution. So by this phase, the insurgents have built up sufficient conventional forces to gain numerical superiority and at least parity in equipment. And this is, you saw this particularly in 1975. The North Vietnamese had definitely got to that stage, and built up the will to win to such an extent that victory is virtually assured. So that's how they sought to fight the war. I see I've got another question there. Did part of the political propaganda effect include feeding of the US domestic peace movement, or is my focus mostly on what was happening in Southeast Asia? My focus is mostly on what was happening in Southeast Asia, but I saw very little deliberate feeding of the peace movement or even intelligence collection on it. And in fact, my reading is that in 1968, sort of mid to late 1968, it actually came as a surprise to the North Vietnamese leadership. Just how unpopular the war had become, and so no, and I'll talk about this later. There are very, very few assets in the United States at all. So let's now look at North Vietnamese intelligence doctrine. I'm sorry about these. So for the North Vietnamese, intelligence is something that everybody does. Intelligence is conducted in the same way that as the war it supported, a people's war supported by people's intelligence. So it's a total activity conducted by everyone in every branch or sector of activity all the time. And as you can see there, I've got a couple of or a few quotes from a document in 1950, which gives a directive on how intelligence should be organized. And really, documents go on to explain our war is a people's war. Military intelligence must not be the exclusive domain of the army. The populations, and above all, the popular troops, it's in inverted commas in the document, must be part of it. If all the possibilities of the population were mobilized in favor of the army, we would be able to remain in charge of the situation and defeat the enemy more rapidly. Of course, there was another side to having intelligence diversified across activity, it meant that no one institution had a monopoly on the knowledge or monopoly on intelligence. So institutions were used to cross-check each other and to decentralize intelligence power to a very large extent. I'm not going to read those quotes out because they will take too much time. But it just gives you a flavor of how the North Vietnamese saw intelligence and how it was unified into their overall effort. So what I'm going to talk about now is how intelligence was actually organized. So probably the closest thing the North Vietnamese had to the CIA was the Central Research Agency. And this reported directly to the Politburo and mainly focused on military intelligence. So it drew together military intelligence, what was collected in the field, and also what could be collected from outside Vietnam, and presented that to the Politburo. The rest, the civilian side of it, if you like, was carried out by the Public Security Ministry. And this is where you really start to see the internal security and counterintelligence aspects of North Vietnamese intelligence really coming out, because they were charged with the enforcement of security and order, and the collection of information, investigation, surveillance, and apprehension of criminals and opposition elements. So basically, an opposition element was basically anybody that opposed the Communist Party, or anybody who was a dissenter on any decision or any view held by the party. Sorry, Jeff Fox there is asking, could it be argued that the North Vietnamese were using basic communist intel model used by the USSR and Red China? Yes, in short. And it's very much bound up with Marxist and Maoist views on communism, communist revolution, and communist warfare. And then, I mean, and this is actually where it starts to get hideously complex, is when you try and work out who was doing what in South Vietnam, the intelligence operations in the South. Which, as I put there, I will go through it briefly, but it was very complex due to the amorphous nature of the command structure. So the command in South Vietnam was split, really. The northern provinces were under the direct command of the North Vietnamese Army, and they had a general under General Giap who commanded those troops. But then further south, sort of the provinces around Saigon in particular, was under the auspices of the Central Committee of the People's Revolutionary Government, also referred to as the Central Office for South Vietnam, or COSVN, and that's the term I'll use for it because that was the one in play. Now, COSVN is a very, very difficult organization to try and pin down. The American and South Vietnamese view of it is that it was a formal body that ran everything in South Vietnam and was pretty much like a government in the South. The North Vietnamese view is no, it's a far more disparate organization. Different staff functions were carried out in different geographical locations. And the command responsibilities between COSVN, the North, and North Vietnamese government itself changed throughout the Second Indochina War. So when you're talking about who was in charge at any particular time, you have to be really careful about which time frame you're talking about. But broadly, intelligence was broken down into three areas. There were reconnaissance sections, and these were small teams that would go out in advance of any unit movement or any attack to carry out a total reconnaissance. So they're not just looking at enemy positions, they're looking at the political, economic situation in the villages and hamlets. They're looking at habits of commanders, habits of politicians. So it's an all basically it is all source collection. The messenger system, which was key to North Vietnamese intelligence, and actually was incredibly effective, and the people's intelligence system. So this is collecting from, so not only collecting information from the people on enemy movements, enemy dispositions, enemy habits, morale, etc., but also information about the people. So that was a massive effort. But just to quickly run through the staff section. So broadly speaking, there are 11 staff sections dedicated to intelligence, and this holds for Khos Phi En and the northern provinces. You have the enemy situation study section, which is fairly self-explanatory. What they call the CADA, I think you say cadre in the United States, an organization section, basically HR, human resources. The ground reconnaissance section, so these are the scouts. The technical reconnaissance section, which was the limited SIGINT capability they had. The people's intelligence nets section, so that's collecting the information from the people and about the people. The espionage section, so these are the covert clandestine covert or clandestine collection elements. So these are the agents in place. The law enforcement sections, that's counterintelligence, and obviously clamping down on dissenters. The techniques and track sections, so we're talking about IMINT and forgery here. The rear services section, which is logistics, the training section, and then the crypto section, which did all the decoding and encoding of messages between headquarters. So you can see it's quite a complex organization. And as I said, when you're trying to look at this, when you're trying to figure out exactly who's responsible for anything at any one particular time, it really is almost a sort of month by month, right? Okay, in May 1965, it was this lot. In June 1965, it was somebody else. But you can see it's quite a sophisticated element there. Frederick, that's quite a big question, and I probably can't really answer that in this session, but if we want to discuss that sometime offline, we can. I don't really cover it too much in the article. So let's talk about what does all this mean? What did I find? How good were they? And what are we talking about in terms of the model? So successes. So success was mainly in the area of human and OSINT. It's some big successes, particularly in the insertion of high-level assets and agents of influence. Arguably, one of the most successful of these was the journalist Pham Juan An, who worked for Reuters and Time magazine. He joined the Communist Party in the 1950s and was sent to the US by the party to train as a journalist, but also to learn as much as possible about Americans. During the war, he was credited by the North Vietnamese with providing the early warning that made possible the Viet Cong victory at back in 1964. He also provided early warning of the first US deployment of troops in 1965. And since the American policy at the time was to give press advance confidential information about forthcoming operations, Anne was able to pass this on to Hanoi. And even before the Tet Offensive, he drove around Saigon identifying key targets for the NVA VC troops once they'd infiltrated the city. Another highly placed informant was Hun Van Trong, an aide in the Office of the Presidential Political Assistant, who was unmasked in 1971, and he'd been providing high-level political intelligence to the North Vietnamese all that time. But this even highlights problems with strategic or national-level intelligence. And the journalist, throughout his account of his wartime activities, he tells how he was both collector and analyst, explaining US strategic thinking to Hanoi. Toward the end of the war, he was even approached with a view to sending him to the US as a refugee in an attempt to plug the intelligence gap, Hanoi having no intelligence assets in the US itself. And we talked about that with regard to the peace movement just a short while ago. His account of the time leading up to the final 75 offensive is also illuminating. The attacks on Thuc Long at the end of 1974 and Banh Mi Tot in February 75 were largely intended by the North Vietnamese to gauge the extent of US continued support for South Vietnam. So they wanted to see if the Americans would respond to these offensives. Anne said that Hanoi was skeptical of his reporting that the US would not return to aid South Vietnam in the event of a full-scale offensive. But other significant successes included gaining possession of the entire RVN strategic Hamlet plan in 1963, gaining the possession of the 1970 Pacification and Rural Development Plan in 1970, and a key report on the state of the Vietnamese armed forces in 1974. And it's quite clear now, you know, just how important that particular piece of information was. These last were on microfilm, and it's not clear how much the information actually got out, because one of the couriers carrying some of this that information was intercepted. But for me, I think what really highlights how the North Vietnamese did intelligence and how good they were at it are actually a couple of failures. The first was the failure to exploit an uprising in the northern provinces of South Vietnam in 1966. And the second was the failure to correctly gauge the public mood in South Vietnam and the extent to which the South Vietnamese army would stand and fight during the Tet Offensive in 1968. And as I've also alluded to, the fact, how unpopular the war had become in the United States also became also came as a surprise to the North Vietnamese. So what happened in February in 1966? Basically, the commander of the First Corps region, the South Vietnamese general, was a very popular general, but he was sacked, and that precipitated a 4-month period of unrest. With increasingly violent demonstrations by Buddhist opponents of the South Vietnamese government. And this led to street fighting in Da Nang and Hue. But it's not really until June, when the thing's being wrapped up, that you start to see the North Vietnamese try to exploit the situation. And I've looked at the US Marine Corps intelligence reports, and they don't report an increase in proselytization, propaganda, or intelligence collection on this until May. And then in June, and they report that the VC appear to have been slow to take the initiative to exploit the recent political unrest. However, they've gained some momentum. So they're quite late to the party here. And they talk about some of the things that they did. Very quickly after this, however, the North Vietnamese effort to exploit this uprising drops, and they revert back to their previous plan of trying to influence and disrupt the planned elections for September 1966. So, really, what we're seeing here is, first of all, this belies the opinion of some that it was a communist-inspired uprising, but also indicates that the North Vietnamese also failed to predict it and appear to be playing catch-up. And then the slow response, I say, also indicates a certain institutional inertia that one would not expect in an insurgent movement, and that they were either unwilling or unable to divert resources from the planned campaign to disrupt the elections in September. The second intelligence failure arguably comes prior to the Tet Offensive in 1968, when it was expected that the population would rally to the communist side and the South Vietnamese army would either fail to fight or would rebel against the government and come across. And a COSVN training document in March 68 outlines the failure of these two key objectives. The document claims that 1.5 million people were liberated, but it points out the organized popular forces were not broad and strong enough, and we have not had specific plans for motivating the masses to the extent that they would indulge in violent armed uprisings. And they also admit that they failed to undermine the capability of the South Vietnamese armed forces. The document states that inadequate attention had been paid to this task, and therefore they failed to achieve this objective. So a number of possibilities arise here. First, it's possible the North Vietnamese intelligence were aware there was insufficient support within the population, but the decision was taken to go ahead anyway. Or that they did, the assessment wasn't passed on because it contradicted the Politburo's view of the situation. And that they were also completely unaware they hadn't done enough to prepare the ground for the Tet Offensive. So again, that probably would have been quite difficult to predict. So really, though, I think what those two failures tell us is that at a tactical level, there was some good work going on, that they had a good understanding of what was going on, but there was no capability to actually collect and report on an operational or strategic level and be able to successfully do anything with that. So moving on then, so obviously heavily reliant, as I said, on Huemint and OSINT. So apart from the key sort of the agents in place that I've talked about, the remaining human was collected by ordinary people going out of their business. In the world of people's intelligence, everyone, particularly in contested areas or those not under control of the North Vietnamese, was expected to report anything useful to the party or the VC. Roadside stall holders were expected to report troop movements, or farmers near airfields were similarly expected to report on aircraft movements. And also, workers on bases were expected to collect information, often about the locations of likely targets, for indirect fire attacks, but also, crucially, for bomb damage assessments, so how effective the attacks were. And there are reports, particularly in the US Marine counterintelligence reports, of them catching workers actually pacing out distances within bases to be able to report back for mortar strikes. And then, of course, we have the collection on the people themselves. The NVAVC were able to identify those who shirked their duties by the intensive personal surveillance that went with people's intelligence. At home, people were monitored by their neighbours in a system that grouped households together with 3 to 5 households in each group. At work, people were required to join the appropriate labour organisations. Those who didn't work, such as children and old people, were expected to join civic organisations such as the Junior Vanguards or Salvation Youth. So you can see how, this was a dual purpose. So these organisations were used as reporting mechanisms for report for information about the enemy, but also about the people themselves. So OSINT was also, as I said, a valuable source of information, and this is where the messenger system really shows its strength. Because basically every day at 5 p.m., messengers would leave various points in South Vietnam with copies of the next day's papers printed in the afternoon. And they were taken to COSVN's press analysis section, which would comb the papers for useful military, political, and economic information, which was then passed on to Hanoi. One captured senior NVA official estimated that 80% of the information gathered about South Vietnam came from the press and other sources. Now, this is really interesting because we see that same figure for intelligence these days. When we talk about American intelligence, British intelligence, we see that same figure, 80% coming from OSINT. So, for example, the Prime Minister's Office published an annual almanac of key officials that included their personal details, such as home addresses and phone numbers. And this was seen later, obviously, as a key OPSEC weaknesses. So, moving on, I realise I'm time is pressing. So, suffered from a lack of technical collection means, and were often reliant on allies. This is certainly true. They tried to glean what they could from the Soviets and from the Chinese. So, for example, weather meteorological information would come from the Russians, and they combined this, interestingly, with the reports from people around airfields with takeoff times and directions to work out where airstrikes were going to be. But they didn't have a particularly technical, particularly good sort of technical collection themselves. Exceptional counterintelligence, and this is true. You see comments, not even their allies, not even the Soviets and Chinese were able to penetrate the Politburo and North Vietnamese intelligence. And the South Vietnamese and the CIA also had very, very limited success in trying to actually penetrate organizations. Most of the intelligence successes came from captured documents and captured personnel. And then, when we're talking about the internal security and counterintelligence as well, the massive efforts regarding internal security and population control. Because although Vietnam was considered a war among the people, for the North Vietnamese it was a war for control of the people. The political struggle to gain the support of and control over the population in the South was more than a means to an end for the Vietnamese communists. It was, in fact, a vital war aim. The Politburo almost certainly learned the lessons of the First Indochina War when they failed to gain a meaningful foothold amongst the more politically and religiously diverse southern population. The Vietnamese communists needed to ensure that by the end of the war, they'd not only gained sufficient support to win, but that they would be in a position to crush the potential opposition to their rule from Catholics, Buddhists, nationalists, and other smaller organizations. And in fact, when the war ended in May 75, the importance placed on post-war control of the population rapidly became apparent as the North Vietnamese capitalized on their network of political cadre members and military presence to dominate the South. And the North Vietnamese were also able to exploit the shock effect of the speed of their advance, and people from the South flocked to the communist banner rather than take the risk of forming an opposition. Obviously, there was significant intelligence support to covert action, and we've seen that, in the use of OSINT, in the use of HUMINT, to identify targets. And of course, as we know, there were large-scale terrorist bombing attacks in Saigon, in the major cities, and against military units. The problem was that the total intelligence effort meant there was a lot of chaff in with the wheat. A significant amount of the reporting was actually very poor. Certainly, a lot of the captured documents were badly written, they were incomplete, or they were just factually incorrect. And of course, this absorbed a great deal of analytical time and effort to sort out the good from the bad and made it very difficult to present a coherent picture. So, to summarize, then, I found that North Vietnamese intelligence activity did conform to the gentry model, but they were a hybrid non-state actor. You have state-like activity in the north itself, but the war was fought of an insurgency because of the command, control, and communication issues. There's plenty of stories of, how basically information had to be conveyed by messenger, by hand, between the main commands and Hanoi and the logistics issues. When units got south of the border, essentially they were guerrillas and they were fighting as a guerrilla army, and that's how their intelligence behaved. So that was my findings. Obviously, that generates further questions when it comes to non-state actors. But I just thought it was an interesting, not only validation of John Gentry's model, but also a better understanding of how the communist insurgency conducted intelligence. And that's me done. Anybody has questions?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that discussion, David. I think that was very, very interesting and looking forward to see what other questions come up in the chat. So where do you see some of this stuff going next for you in this research process?
Really, once we've got this special edition done, and we sort of see where the debate goes. But I think it's interesting and valuable in its own right, because if you're fighting an insurgency, then understanding how they do intelligence and what their intelligence strengths and weaknesses are, I think will be of enormous benefit. And equally, sometimes we support insurgencies, so understanding, where their gaps will be, will help us when it comes to support those insurgencies that we want to support. But in the broader terms of intelligence studies, I think what it does is it really starts to break the debates out of just national security and sort of counter-terrorism, which is what we seem to be locked into at the moment. Sorry, we've got some
Okay.
questions pinging up now.
Yeah, looks like Frederick's got a question. So how much work have you done on insurgency intelligence efforts in the Middle East, North Africa, or Southwest Asia?
Very little, actually. Well, apart from sort of in my previous life, very little academically. The problem we have, of course, is because they're ongoing, it's difficult to get enough information about them. It's one of those things, unfortunately, we'll only sort of really know in the fullness of time, when we have access to captured documents. But from what I can understand, what I have seen, they don't seem to vary too much from this model.
Yeah, it looks like everybody gained a lot from the discussion today, which is great. This is what we want.
Questions. I was really hoping there would be a North Vietnamese expert who could kind of challenge me.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited to see that edition come out and take a look at the work that everybody put into it. I know it's always nice when you have those coherent themes in journals, which I really appreciate.
We're really looking forward to sort of see, obviously seeing when it comes out, but then seeing the debates it generates. Will it generate more work? As Frederick says, will people start to do more work on the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia? Or will it become one of those things, they'll sort of use that model and start to, say, right, okay, well, if they should be doing intelligence like this, let's see if they do. So it almost becomes a
Yeah,
predictive
no,
model
absolutely.
in trying to identify what insurgents might be doing intelligence-wise. I think that, to be brutally honest, though, I think the reliance on humans and OSINT probably, doesn't really come as a surprise to anybody, really. But
Right. No, I think that's something that will always be key.
yeah.
Well, thank you guys all for attending. I want to be respectful of everyone's time, and I also want to put in a plug for the next Intel Hub session, which will occur on Wednesday, July 17th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time again. So please do keep an eye out for that announcement. And I'm also working on getting a registration page set up for the Intel Hub so we can be a little bit more efficient in making sure that you guys get the content that you need when you need it. So if you have any questions or any follow-up, and again, if you also have ideas for speakers or if you yourself would like to do a presentation, please don't hesitate to reach out to me, and I can help work to get you on the schedule. I know we have openings in September through December of this year, and then we'll start planning for 2020. So please do send me your ideas, and have a great rest of your days.
Yeah, thank you all very much. And those of you in the United States, happy 4th of July tomorrow.